I want to thank everyone in the name of my family for being here. It's, as you know, the onset of my father, but I want to include this seum also for my brother, Tom, and anybody here who has somebody, and I'm sure we all do, who is very near to them, who's passed away. This learning now should be a segula, and it should be for them as well, so it's for all of us together. The word shas, which takes in the whole Talmud, shas, really means shisha sadarim. It means shin, it's an abbreviation, shin sadarim, six orders. And those orders take in every part of Jewish life. Whatever you can think of, it's included in it. But the one which Chagiga is in, that's the one which I finished recently, is in Seder Moed. And that is the... And Seder Moed has to do with Shabbos and with the Yomim Tovim and fast days. Very interesting, as there was all the holidays. And Chagiga is the last... In Moed, it's the last Gemara. So the Rambam asks, how come it's the last one? Why isn't it the first or the middle one? Why did it get the last place in this order? And the answer he gives is Bishvil She'eno Inyan Klali, because this is not deals with Klal Yisrael, with all of the Jewish people. Elo Al Haschorim, only on the males. Kamo She'nema Yeroeh Chol Zechucho. All your males shall come to Jerusalem three times a year. So what is this Chagiga? Three times a year, all males are commanded to go to the Beis HaMikdash. And that's why Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos are called Shalosh Regalim. Regalim comes from the word regel. Regel is foot or leg. And in those days, they didn't have the eged buses. I don't think Eged might dispute that, but they had donkeys and they had mainly their legs, which took them. They walked to Jerusalem. And that's why it's called Shalosh Regalim. Pilgrim festivals is the fancy English for it. Now, the Torah commands them not to appear empty-handed. They were supposed to bring things with them. And here is what they were supposed to bring with them. First, a korban olo. Which is also called an Ola Re'iya, a sacrifice of seeing, the Holy Temple. And this was an Ola sacrifice, is consumed entirely on the altar. It's burned in its entirety. But another thing they had to bring also was a Korban Shlomim. Comes from the word Shalom, peace. This Korban Shlomim is also known as the Shalmei Chagiga, from the word Chag, Yontif, a holiday. And that's why our Masechta Chagiga got its name. And it's very interesting to note that on our Seder plate, you know, we have the Zroah. That's the shank bone which commemorates the Korban Pesach, especially only sacrificed on Passover. But we also have the egg. And the egg represents the Korban Chagiga. That is representative of that sacrifice which is sacrificed on the Shalosh Regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. And it was also a mitzvah to bring a Shalmei Simcha to promote Simchas Yontif. And this was used when there was not enough of the other Karbonos, so they would fall back on these backup Karbonos, so that all the people, you see, the Korban Shlomim, people ate from it. Part of it was given to the Kohen, but they had big, big meals in Jerusalem where they would eat from this Korban. And they used to have meat and wine. That was called a simcha, a meal of simcha was with meat and with wine. And that's what they would take with them. Now, before concluding the Masechta, right, the last part of it, I wanted to just deal, after this little introduction, of one of the topics, the sugyos, in Perek Sheni. And I had a few handouts. You may or not have picked it up, but I'll read it very, very slowly, and I'm sure you'll be able to follow me. The Gemara says at the beginning of Perek Sheni, Ein Dorashin Ba'aroyos Bishlosho. A teacher of Torah is not allowed to teach about illicit relationships in the presence of three students. Now, I don't know if this is kept today, but it was apparently in the days of the Mishnah. A teacher of Torah has to be extremely careful in his presentation. And the Mishnah implies that there are many unions which are not specified in the Torah, and students may not be aware of them. Now, if a teacher has a class of three students, according to the Mishnah and the commentaries, here's what could happen. He speaks, let's say, to one of the students. He has a close discussion with one student. The other two students are sitting there, and what do? They start talking with each other. So when they do that, they're going to miss what the teacher is saying. So they're going to get into a discussion of their own. And that is very, very dangerous, according to the Mishnah. So therefore, if there's three students in the class, the teacher should say, look, I'm not going to discuss arroyos. I'm not going to discuss illicit relationships. And I want to tell you that even in our own day, there are problems like this. For example, it can happen. People who are not very into Torah learning, that a young lady who is a convert will marry a Kohen, which is not supposed to happen. And a few years later, they become Balei Tshuva, and they want to do the right thing, and oy ve'avoy, they find out that they are in an illicit relationship, one that even the Torah forbids. And so these are things which could lead to very, very serious matters. And not only will the students perhaps make mistakes, but they will perhaps not teach others the proper way. So this is something that should definitely be avoided. And the Mishnah says, not with three. Yeah, the teacher shouldn't do it. And then the next thing is, v'lo b'maseh v'reshis b'shnayim. A teacher should not teach the maseh v'reshis, which really means the creation of the world, the whole maaseh, the whole situation of the creation of the world, even with two. The reason the Rambam gives, it's so difficult to understand that the average person can only understand a tiny part of the process of creation and its aftermath. And it should only be taught to one student at a time. That's how careful the teachers were in the days of the Mishnah. Any distraction which could brought about with many students could lead to serious error. We know that this is a problem even today. We Jewish people look upon nature with a great deal of love and appreciation of God. For example, when we hear thunder and lightning, there's a bracha. There's a bracha for thunder, there's a bracha for lightning. When we see the Mediterranean the first time in 30 days, that you also say Yama Godol, we make a blessing over the ocean. We make a blessing when we see, we just had recently, the congregation got together and we made a blessing of trees that were budding, fruit-bearing trees for the first time in the year. We also made a blessing. So we see nature as a reflection of Hashem, as a reflection of God. But not the whole world. There are many who deify nature. Stargazers, moon worshippers, sun worshippers. And we have this a great deal. And that's why a teacher has to be extremely careful. For example, eclipses have been looked upon with great dread in the past. People thought that the world was coming to an end. So it's very, very it's very important that that we don't emulate the things that happen that other nations fall into. And the Mishnah, as I say, is so careful that it says even that we shouldn't be teaching two people at a time, two students, it should only be one-on-one so that the person should really understand it. Another thing which we have, incidentally, today, which is a very, very intense argument, even on the political scene, having to do with this exact Mishnah, is the question of evolution. I saw when the Republican candidates were standing in a row and somebody said, all those who believe in evolution, raise your hand. All those who don't believe in evolution, raise your hand. I didn't quite see how this fits into a political situation, but evolution is a big, big, fiery subject being debated in America today, and we Jewish people have our very strong opinions, which of course are the right ones, because they've been tested for 4,000 years and they've always been correct. And that's what the Mishnah is trying to bring out, that it shouldn't even be one teacher and two students, but this subject, which is so careful and so difficult, should be one-on-one. The Tiferes Israel, incidentally, says that Maaseh Bereishis refers to Kabbalah, which teaches that first Hashem, God, created spiritual worlds. This is very difficult. And ultimately, finally, gradually, our material world was created. Now, we're continuing right along. V'lobe me'kobo v'yochid. Ella imkein hu hoyochocham o'meidin midato. Now, the Maaseh me'kobo you should be aware of because we read it as the Haftorah on the first day of Shavuos. And this is the vision that Yechezkel, Ezekiel, had. It's called the Act of the Chariot. And the Rambam explains this chapter symbolically, showing the totality of existence, God's knowledge, attributes, the definition of angels, the neshama, the soul, the mind, the attributes of what occurs after death. It's extremely difficult. And as I mentioned in shul that time, my father, Olam Shalom, told me once that German chumashim do not translate this chapter, this Haftorah. Why? Because if a person doesn't know Hebrew, he shouldn't even be exposed to this, because it's so difficult and it's so open to misinterpretation that it's better not even that he should know it at all. It should be kept from people who don't know it. But the fact, in fact, I did see one. I saw an Adler, I think it is, Machzor recently, and I looked for the first day of Shavuos, and actually, it was not translated. It was only in Hebrew. The prophet is very detailed, and all Kabbalah is really based on this vision of Ezekiel's. I mean, imagine to see a vision of God and trying to place it into words is not an easy thing. It was very difficult, I'm sure, for the prophet, and it's difficult for us to understand. And I wanted to just mention as an aside that, you know, we have today in America, I think, the greatest translation possibility that we've ever had in the world. Art Scroll is translating just about everything. Now, I think that it's a wonderful thing, because it opens up Torah learning to people who otherwise just couldn't do it. But on the other hand, there's a little bit of a danger there, because this translation should only be an aid, an assistance, a prop to help a person understand. But there are people I know who just read the English. They read the English Talmud. They can make a siyum on the entire Talmud and not be able to read a line of Hebrew. And that's not good. That's very misleading. Because translation, no matter how good, is not the original. And when we use an art scroll or any translation, we should only use it when we get into trouble with the Hebrew, which can happen, especially the Aramaic. We look at the art scroll, okay, fine, and then we go back. But we certainly should study all the texts in the original language. Now the next thing, finally, we also read, Kol Yistachel Ve'avod Dvorim, Roylo Ki'ilu Lo Bol Olam. Anyone who delves into the following four matters, it would be better had he not been created. Now that's a very, very strong statement. Well, what are we talking about? Because we know that Judaism is very much in favor of unlimited study in virtually every field. But Judaism also stops us at a certain point, because excessive speculation in some areas cannot end in any benefit. Just as all human senses, the mind is a finite creation and cannot go beyond its frame of reference. For example, just think a minute. Did you ever ask yourself, well, what happened? What happened before God? You know, sometimes we think thoughts like that. Well, it's an impossible question. According to Rashi, I think it's Rashi who said it, it's like a fish trying to find out what fire is. He's in the water. He can't understand fire in the water. Because time is a creation, and we live by time. What happens in eternity? I mean, questions which can really drive a person insane, if a person really goes into it without stopping. And so the Mishnah tells us, you better wouldn't have been created if you're going to start delving into things which are absolutely beyond your knowledge. Because, you see, our nose, for example, we can smell a certain distance. We can hear a certain distance. Today, when I was walking on the street outside, they were pumping something from under the ground. You could get such a headache, it kept going on and on. And as I walked away from it, thankfully, the sound got less and less. And finally, I didn't hear a thing. Because that's as far as my ears would go. And our eyes can see a certain distance. Now, definitely, our mind is the same thing. Granted, we only use 8%, but even if we used 100%, there is a limit. So what is the Mishnah telling us? What are these terrible things that we shouldn't delve into too much? Mala mala, mala mata. What is above and what is below? Now it's difficult to know exactly what the Gemara had in mind with the word above. Rashi indicates that what is physically below the world, which we really don't know, way, way down. I mean, it's very, very scary. And what's really below? I mean, I know they said you keep digging, you get to China. But I'm not so sure. I don't know where you're going to end up if you keep digging. I don't know if you can. And now let's look malamato, malamala, what's above us. Think about it. Just forget the spiritual part, just the physical part. We are living in one galaxy. We are one pinpoint in one galaxy. There are infinite amount of galaxies outside our galaxy. Can you imagine the vastness of space? It can turn a person's mind. Just to get to Venus or one of those planets. Now they're saying a trillion years away. I mean, if we can buy a ticket on the plane, it'll take about 300 years to get there. We might miss it. they say they found water, trillion. I don't know how many years away, trillion light years, and maybe there's humanity because they found water. One little planet. My feeling always has been, with Lawrence's permission, I think Chabad has been there a long time ago. But that's you know there. So anyway, so when we start thinking about things like that, there's a point where you can really get mature. And it's something that the Mishnah says is not a good idea. In fact, the Rambam, who is a very great rationalist, says it's like a person who keeps trying to read something which is too small for his eyes. And he keeps squinting and keeps trying and trying, and finally he's going to damage his eyesight. He's not going to read it, but he's going to damage his eyesight. So that's the way the Rambam compares this. Finally, this Mishnah that I'm covering now says that anybody who does not have respect for the kavod, for the honor of his maker, of God, it would be better for him if he had not come into the world. Now, again, what are we talking about here? There is the situation of delving into things that we know we cannot. So it's almost a type of disrespect of God. There are two interpretations to this that are given. One is the difference between a ganav and a gazlan. There's a halachic difference. What is a gazlan? A gazlan is a highway man, a bank robber. He is open in what he does. He's wrong. He is sinful. He is illegal. He has no right to do what he did. But he admits it. We know the famous bank robbers were. So he's not hiding from people, and obviously not hiding from God. He does it publicly. Wrong, but publicly. A ganav is a different kind of person. A ganav is a pickpocket. A ganav is a person maybe who changes his books a little bit. A ganav is a person who hides his stealing. But what he fails to realize is that while he may be hiding it from people, if he believes in God, then he cannot hide it from God, and he's making an effort to hide his wrongdoing from God. And this, according to halacha, is actually both are bad. But a ganav, in many ways, is worse than a gazlan because of that situation. So anybody who does not have kavod for his maker, the explanation is this is one of the things, is like the difference between a ganav and a gazlan. But then there is another one, and that is the people who go into these speculations. They almost don't have respect for God. Like saying, God, I'm going to be smarter than you. I'm going to outdo you, because I'll explain things to myself even better than you did when you created the world. I know it sounds crazy, but there are people. In fact, in the Talmud, in our own Talmud today, Chagiga, on Daf Yud Dalet Omer Beis, the 14th Daf, we read the famous, famous story, I'm sure you've heard of it, about the four great rabbis who entered the Pardes, who entered the vineyard. And we don't know exactly what they did. These were great, great rabbis. But they did something whereby they were able to enter into a situation which is above and beyond human comprehension. They were Rabbi Akiva, Ben Zoma, Ben Azai, and Acher. That's Elisha Ben Avunya. And this is clearly explained in the Talmud. Whether they said God's secret name, maybe they knew something that, or whether they did some incantation, I don't know how they did it, but they went into a supernal world. But they got into trouble. First of all, Ben Zoma became mentally unstable. He totally went out of his mind. Just went crazy as a result. He saw things that he could not comprehend, and he couldn't handle, he couldn't absorb them, and it was very sad because he was a great rabbi. Ben Azai actually hatzitz vomes. The one, Ben Zoma was hatzitz v'nifka, he went crazy, and Ben Azai hatzitz looked vomes, and he died. Died on the spot. And some people say that this was really a neshikas Hashem. It was a kiss of God. You know, we have a saying in our religion, I don't know if you've ever heard it, that, you know, sometimes people unfortunately suffer before they die, which is very sad, but it's part of life. But some people just quietly fall into a sleep. And they're not alive anymore. And we have a saying that that is neshikat Hashem. That's a kiss of God. And he just kisses the person, and the soul leaves, and it's over, and that's it. So anyway, that's what happened to Ben Azai. Acher, who's called the other one, they don't even mention his name anymore in the Talmud, Elisha ben Avuya, became an agnostic or an atheist. He turned against his own people. He also got all jumbled up. And the only one, Rabbi Akiva, it says, Yotza b'shalom. He entered and he went out b'shalom, a much, much wiser man, but a man who skirted disaster. I don't know if Rabbi Akiva would have done it twice. So this is what the Mishnah tells us, that we should not go into these things which are above and beyond our intellectual parameters. So this is the part of the Gemara that I wanted to say, to go over with you. And now I want to go to the very end of the Gemara, Chagiga, the very last part, and then say the Hadran. And here we go. It says here, let's see if I find it. Omar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish said, Reish Lakish, by the way, was a very interesting teacher in the Talmud. He was a thief. He was a robber. He was a robber. And the Torah, the Talmud doesn't hide it, Reish Lakish. He was a regular robber. And he totally turned around his life, which shows how people can change. And he became one of the great, great rabbis. Rabbi Akiva, for that matter, also, you know, until the age of 40, knew nothing. And his wife saw in him some great things. And her father kicked them out. And they lived like beggars. And finally, Rabbi Akiva went to Yavne to study. And when he came back after 12 years, his wife had to sell her hair so that they could make a little money that she could just get by. And when she came home after 12 years and knocked, he was just about to knock on the door, she was sitting with her friends, his wife, and they said, "You're so foolish, Rachel. What are you doing this for? Get rid of this husband." And he's sitting in Yavne. That's her life? She said, "He's coming home. But I want to tell you something. If he would study in Yavne another 12 years, I'd be the happiest woman in the world." You know what he did? Turned around, never knocked on the door, went back to Yavne, studied another 12 years, and became possibly the greatest rabbi of his time. And when he came to visit his town, and everybody came to see him, the big shots, the mayor, and all the big people, this little lady was trying to push her way through. And they said, "Get away from here, this isn't for you." So Rabbi Akiva sees and said, "You leave her alone, because if it wasn't for that woman, I'd be lying on my back now in a field and be just a plain shepherd. Everything that I have, I owe to my wife, to Rachel." So this is a beautiful, beautiful story which shows how Rabbi Akiva changed his life. And Reish Lakish, who was a highwayman, he was a robber, and he became a great rabbi. So it shows that, you know, we're all good people, but we can really become something like you can't believe. So anyway, Reish Lakish said, "Ein wush al Gehinnom sholetes b'fosha Yisrael." The fires, the bad things of hell, of Gehinnom, does not rule over sinners of Israel. Kal v'chomem mizbeach hazav. We learn it from the golden altar, because the golden altar has just a very thin layer of gold, and the years and years, and the fire from the sacrifices cannot get through it. So Hoshe Yisroel, so the sinners of Israel, Shemelein mitzvos kerima, who still do a lot of mitzvos, even a sinner, you know, a person, you know, they say in the Jewish religion, a person says, "Thank God I'm an atheist." That's how a Jew says he's an atheist. We all have mitzvahs, no matter how bad a person is. So certainly for them, they will not have anything to do with Gehinnom. And we who are not Rishonim, we who really try to do the right things, certainly have nothing like that, but look forward to Olam Haba, as I'm sure that my father, my brother, and your relatives is the same situation. So having completed this now, I'm going to say the Hadlach.